You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Morgan Quaintance, and this is the 2019 end of year and end of decade studio visit special. Make some noise, everybody, in the studio. So joining me to discuss the highlights of 2019 this evening are curators Amanpreet Sandhu.
Hi, Morgan.
Jonathan Ali.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by researchers and theorists Denise Kwan.
Hello.
Xia Zhou.
Hi.
And Chun Yang.
Hello.
Who were all participants in the best conference I attended this year.
Hey.
But first, if there's one word to describe the 2010s, then that word is austerity. The decade began with George Osborne's policy of expansionary fiscal contraction, or in plain English, public spending cuts. The excuse was deficit reduction, but the ideological drive was privatisation, and the arts were no exception. Following a 200% rise in higher education tuition fees in 2010, regularly funded arts organisations felt the burn of significant cuts to their arts council grants, budgets were slashed and institutions closed. The reaction saw a cash-hungry art world run to the private sector. But as French writer Honoré de Balzac apparently wrote, according to Wikipedia that I checked earlier, behind every great fortune is a great crime. And so the art world became linked to arms dealing through the Zabludovitches, BAE Systems and Yana Peel, abuse through Anthony de Offay, opioid epidemics through the Sacklers, support for a right-wing government through Leonard Blavatnik, and a whole load of tax evasion and financial secrecy from just about everybody else. Just as the British state has raised the stinking cadaver of nationalism to cover its own march towards privatisation, the art world turned to internationalism to cover its own complicity. The thing is, 4 years ago, politics, activism, or the concerns of so-called marginal subjects were of little interest to the majority of writers, curators, institutions, and artists. But now their currency is through the roof. The margins, area studies, feminism, queer politics, decolonisation and critical race theory are suddenly much desired and suddenly very profitable. But why is this so? For some, this is the change they've been waiting for. But for me, it's a clear agenda of virtue signalling. Or to borrow a Marxist term, it's a kind of primitive accumulation where a sector in crisis, a sector that must surrender its already slim moral compass in order to access money, is in harvesting the cultural capital of those artists and individuals who could otherwise alter its restrictive structural components. The question we have to ask ourselves is this. If the socio-cultural foundations of the 21st century have been laid in its first two decades, what kind of a future can we look forward to? The horizon looks bleak. If the last years of this decade have been marked by the performance of political engagement, then the first few years of the 2020s must be used to expose those performers and to unite those who truly believe in making a difference and not just profiting from difference. But 2019 wasn't all bad. And to prove it, my first guests, Denise Kwan, Xia Zhou and Chun Yang, were all participants in one of the best events I saw this year. British Chinese Women was an interdisciplinary workshop centred on the subjectivities, experiences and representations of British Chinese women. It was a half-day event, but it was crammed with brilliant presentations and papers related to a much neglected field. So, Denise,
hello.
Thanks for being on the show tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Come a bit closer. I wanted to start by asking you, so if to me, the event felt really foundational. It mm-hmm. felt like the first time that I'd seen those sorts of voices and that sort of discourse in a space together. But actually, you traced a lineage back to 1988 and a conference called or held by the National Federation of Chinese Women that was held in Birmingham. Mm. So has there been much activity since then?
I mean, definitely not. Definitely not.
I think as a researcher, probably my research project that looked at the objects and stories of British Chinese women started probably about 5 years ago. And I was kind of going, so, you know, to kind of talk about this lack of absence, you know, kind of really came back to my own experience, really, and, you know, finding my own mother's pyjamas, you know, and starting that discourse and starting to have that conversation, you know, about migration and how that's related to materiality. And then I thought, you know, this could be an amazing way to collect different stories from other British Chinese women within the UK. And at that point, I remember thinking, how am I going to, you know, bring together a group of women to take part in this research project? And what really distilled in that moment was this kind of crisis where I thought, oh my God, I need to do this PhD. But I literally know 1.5 British Chinese women to take part in. You know, so that sense of absence was very much experienced on a very personal level. But then thinking, maybe this is my fault. You know, maybe the party is happening and I'm just not part of the party. You know, it's constantly this feeling of this isolated experience, you know, and I'm somebody who was born in Wales from a British Chinese Hong Kongese background, and wanting to run this project and thinking, oh my God, I need to collect at least 30 women to take part, and having this kind of this desert of absence, you know. And I suppose I kind of see my own research project as being a way to create a path through this desert, right? Where I brought together two generations of British Chinese women through art participatory practices and looking at the stories of women through their material objects, right? And so I worked with a first generation group of women up in Haringey, so I worked with them for 8 months. And I worked with a second generation group. And so from this project, I really saw an amazing value in bringing women together in order to create space through art and to create dialogue and all those things that I had kind of embodied and internalized, you know, kind of racisms essentially about who gets to be creative, right? Became an enormous learning point for me, you know. And through the context of the project, I just realized, wow, this is a really powerful way to create a discourse, right? To counter this isolation that is happening in Britain in context of British Chinese culture. I mean, British Chinese migration to the UK is very much marked by a dispersal of people, of groups through a very privatized form of labor. So historically through the takeaway. So all that, you know, is very powerful in terms of creating this isolated, dispersed kind of settlement pattern that is incredibly influential in segregating voices and silencing these voices. So I see, you know, so I saw the research project as a way to counter that and to create a dialogue, you know, from multiple points. And so, yeah, so that is, yeah, so that kind of came out of my own project. And, you know, and then at the end of that, I was thinking, okay, right, I've done this. You know, I've worked with these two generations of women and it's been absolutely, you know, I learned so much from it. But I thought, okay, where is this going to go now? And, you know, and over the course of the project, I started to meet Chun and I started to meet Sha. And this was also really incredible, you know, to meet other women doing similar work. And I thought, you know, and again, we were doing work in different fields and how to bring those conversations together within one space. And that's where the idea kind of came from, really, is to have a contemporary dialogue about British Chinese women right now.
And I think for me, what was amazing about the day was that when I was thinking back, my memory of it was that it was a full day, but it was actually half a day.
It was half a day.
And felt so packed, and you'd really brought a broad spectrum of like interdisciplinary research through bringing them together. For me, it felt like a landmark, like a real foundational moment, you know. Chun, let me bring you in actually, because you presented a paper called "The Online Construction and Representation of Cultural Identity: A Study of British Chinese Community" on YouTube. So, could you just briefly talk a bit about like how people are using YouTube to do this to forge a sense of identity? And yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. And like what Denise just mentioned, that her idea is coming from those isolated experience of the British Chinese. I think that one of the motivations for me to doing that is also that I've read a lot myself. It's not a British Chinese, but I've read a lot and talking a lot with some of my British Chinese friends, and they always mention that they kind of very isolated when they growing up. So one of the way that they connected, an important way to connect it with those people who share their similar experiences through the social media. And so this YouTube as kind of like one of the social media and platform gives them a kind of like very powerful way to connect it with each other and share those kind of emotions, experiences to growing up as a Chinese, which is, you know, isolated from each other. So that's why that this is kind of like one of the very important motivations behind my research project. And when I start my research, I find out that, you know, there's not only the people who are creating this and who people who are watching this, building up the connections, the people actually, you know, within this like online community, they also are pushing the geographical boundaries. They kind of link together by, you know, sharing their similar ideas. And also, you know, there's kind of like a cultural flows actually between the British Chinese and also American Chinese and Australia Chinese. Through this kind of thing, this kind of like activities, like they kind of created a shared online hyphenated community, which is not only, you know, a certain, which is kind of like an identity, which is very limited in a certain geographical place, but, you know, they kind of like a global connected ideas that is creating during this process. So that's why I find this is kind of very interesting. And some of them, like even some of these Chinese from different backgrounds, they come together to do a lot of stuff online, and the platform actually becomes a kind of like a second place, which is the British Chinese can have a voice to acting or to do some actings, do some performance, and you know, they can create their own representations rather being driven by the representations which is created in the mainstream media. Yeah.
Yeah, so it really feels like today, like the sort of contemporary cultural production, there's a real gap between what happens in, let's say, a broadcast television, which is this really old version of what people want to see or how people should be seen, and then what is happening online. In the best circumstances, what is happening online, where people are using the platform to, as they say, self-actualize, or
yes.
You know, so is it like the full raft of expressive techniques being used? So it's not just like beauty, but also music. Like, how is it working?
There's actually lots of different things. For example, that you said, like makeup. So people doing makeup about to showing a part of their identity through, you know, they make sense of their, how they make sense of their bodies. But also, you know, they kind of doing those kind of self-produced short films online during these ways, they're showing their experiences as a Chinese, their isolated feelings or some emotions or some very details, cultivated in the everyday life, those experiences that you can really see on those, you know, blockbusters, or you know, because the mostly in the history, the Chinese people that in the big screen, they always being like created just as some facial signifies. Mm. They don't really say people just saying them as, you know, a Chinese, but no one told their life behind the bodies. But you know, during this process of self-productions, those British and Chinese or American Chinese, they really, you know, digging very deep of their daily life and showing to the media, and to let more people understand what is what does it mean to a diasporic community or diasporic Chinese.
Okay, so yeah. Just let's follow on that point on the sort of diasporic community. So Shah, can I bring you in, please? Because your paper was titled The Migration of Chinese Female females to post-war Britain. So this is seems to me a very neglected story, academically and culturally speaking. So what is your research hoping to find? What have you uncovered?
I think the first thing bring me to it is a very simple fact reflected in census that there are more Chinese women migrated, outnumbered Chinese men in post-war era. So the previous literature is always focusing on Chinese men, especially working class Chinese seamen, and how the British authorities have racially stereotyped them, or they have been racially discriminated against by locals or by police or local authorities. But because of the fact that actually more women, Chinese women than men in Britain, but they have been completely neglected from the historical perspective, that's why I think I want to explore their lives, especially in post-war Britain, how they have settled in Britain and why they came here and how they negotiate their own identities in the families and how just reconcile with their own migration identities and also how they organize together to promote the profile of Chinese women in the British society.
So it sounds to me like your project had a your research project has a kind of similar energy to Denise's in that it feels like you have to do a lot of primary research. Are you meeting a lot of people?
Yeah.
So because there's this sense of isolation, do you find that a community starts to form around you almost because you're the person, you're the connection between all these different people, you're meeting everybody? Is that starting to happen?
I think at the moment what I find about the isolation is it's the isolation of the women or a Chinese, as an ethnic Chinese, is because I'm only looking at the first generation Chinese migrants. And what I find, the isolation is not simply because they are women or they are Chinese. Maybe it's more culturally bound or class bound. So, of course, because I'm looking for people to be interviewed, so there will be a group of people that I have met, made contacts with from community centers or just from random emails or from like newsletters of some Chinese organizations. Yes, but I'm trying to looking for different samples of my interviewees to see like some are from takeaway background, some from more like professional background or like single women or like married women with children. I think I'm trying to look for diversity. Yeah.
And has it been quite a surprising process? Because Denise, maybe I'll just bring you back in again. Because it seemed like it's something. Well, that sense of surprise, I mean, was legible in what you were saying. I mean, how does it feel, sort of having the suspicion that something is out there, but then discovering it like that?
I don't think I knew what I was looking for until it happened at all. I think it was a complete, you know, I did the PhD on a languages department at Westminster. And, you know, there was this sense of risk that comes with working with people, working with art, you know, and there was lots of different kind of, you know, there's so much self-doubt and there was a lot of stereotypes about who is creative and would first generation women want to take part in 8 months of art workshops.
Yeah, I remember you saying people were like that you're never going to get people to speak to you.
Right, exactly. Yeah, there's this thing of you're never going to get first generation British Chinese women who are retired interested in making art with you. They're just interested to play mahjong. They're not interested in your project. Okay, and I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? You know, but actually what happened was that nobody really wanted to talk to me. No one wanted to do interviews with me, but everyone did art workshops with me and everyone did art workshops with me for 8 months. You know, and that was like, that was the complete kind of dismantalization of that stereotype, you know, in terms of first generation women are not creative. And what was really interesting was through art, you know, the women were able to kind of release themselves from this kind of really social, economical narrative, this oppressive narrative, you know, that comes through language. And through the process of making, they kind kind of reinvented their sense of agency, their sense of, you know, their imagined sense of self and desire and ambition with a lot more vitality than you can do with spoken language. You know, so that, so actually art making was far more important for the first generation than it was for the second generation in that way, you know.
Yeah, I was good. I was thinking about that actually, and thinking about you, Chen, because I was thinking, is the first generation, second generation, and possibly third, thinking their creative output is happening elsewhere, maybe online, or I don't know, is that maybe a correct estimation of why there was a split, maybe?
I think for the second generation, what was really powerful from the art workshops was just the very bringing together of a group of women that wouldn't have the opportunity to, you know, whereas with the first generation women, I went to the community centre. They all knew each other. I was going into their space. But the second generation was so difficult to recruit. I was flyering. I was going on radio. I was like, call, get in touch with me. I'm looking for you. Nobody got in touch with me.
But actually, this is very different from what I saw on the YouTube. The most of the people, you know, who involve in on the YouTube creation is the second generation. But at some point, I find their parents sometimes involved in the video creation as well. Like, for example, they playing themselves as the fresh off the boat person, like the parents. And what they're trying to do is just identify the gap between the first generation and second generation. It's like, I just find it's really interesting. Yeah.
I think, something that came out of the workshops was definitely my second generation women saying it'd be great to have workshops with the first generation.
Yeah.
And to really have that cross intercultural dialogue, you know, in a physical space.
Yes,
doing
something. I feel like it's also, you know, when the there's a lot of videos that I saw on the YouTube that the main focus when they, you know, trying to put together the first and second generation, they always focus on the conflicts, the cultural conflicts between them. But sometimes, you know, when people, but when they're trying to discuss this, actually they're has the motivation to build on a dialogue with their, you know, the first generation or their parents. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is a good point for me to talk to you about the future, actually, because I wanted to know, like, where things are going next. So maybe, Shah, can you tell me, I know you're in the middle of doing your research at the moment, so we're not going to spill any secrets. but tell me, where are things heading for you at the moment? Where, I know it was only May, so it's been like 6 months, but yeah.
So I'm still revising my thesis, and I'm now in my last year of writing up stage. So I just need to revise it, and I'm trying to make it into a self-contained piece and then submit it finally.
But is there plans for another British Chinese Women workshop? Will you continue doing this, Denise?
I mean, we've definitely been talking about it, and we've been sort of like collecting different ideas, because I think something that really came out of it, I mean, at the beginning we said, okay, who is going to turn up to this event? We've not seen an event like this ran before. Maybe no one's going to show up, you know. And so when we had this room full of people, we're like, oh my God, this was not what we expected. And I think we all felt as a group how powerful that was, and there was such a real desire to kind of continue this dialogue and to create a discourse, you know, that is multiple, that is flexible, that is open-ended. So we're definitely on the lookout for if there's any spaces, so this is another shout out, if there's any spaces that might want to host a series of events based around British Chinese women, do get in touch. So at the moment we're kind of like thrashing through different ideas and just different formats of
it. Wait, how can people get in touch with you?
How can people get in touch with me?
We do have a British Chinese Women Gmail
account. Yeah,
and also a British Chinese Women Twitter account is for our workshop, but we continue to do it if someone gets in touch with us.
Okay, so what are those?
It's BritishChineseWomen@gmail.com. There's no space or lowercase. Yeah. And the Twitter account is just search British Chinese Women.
Okay. Well, we're going to go to our next section. But before we do that, briefly, Denise, I asked everybody tonight to talk about some of their highlights for the year. And I'm going to try and squeeze in something with you guys before we move on to our next section. Yeah. So, Denise, all of you picked some really interesting things. But Denise, maybe With the idea of future in mind, you had some selections, so maybe just give us a quick rundown of some of those.
Okay. I guess what's been really important for me in the last year is really kind of getting into a lot of the Asian American writers. So I'm thinking of Merlin Wu, I'm thinking of Shaolan Bao, and that's been really useful for me, especially with like the lack of literature around British Chinese women and you know, looking in a Chinese American diasporic sense to look at what is that feminist literature that is coming from that context, you know. So almost, you know, to really contextualize what is going on diasporically in order to kind of, you know, to really understand what is, you know, what the situation is in Britain that has created a situation whereby there is this lack of visibility, you know. So Shaolan Bao's writing about the strikes that were happening led by 20,000 British Chinese women in the New York garment sewing factories was incredibly powerful, you know, and that notion of politicization of American Chinese women, you know, changing labor laws in America and thinking about, okay, in context of British Chinese, it's all been private labor, right? It's all been mostly takeaways. And that in itself has become a really powerful way to kind of disperse and to fragment and keep people quiet in that way. You know, so I think that contextualization is something that has been a really important kind of learning point for me in this last year.
And just quickly, but Asha or Chen, I can't remember which email mentioned this, but somebody mentioned the film, and now I can't remember the title of it, but it's the film
Farewell.
Was it you with Awkwafina?
Yes,
isn't in the main role. So I haven't seen it yet, but I really want to see it. So was this a good film?
Tell me. It was a great film, and I feel like it's kind of a showcase a lot of complicated dynamic relationship between the family, which happens in the families. And I strongly recommend it. If someone, you know, listen to this, you can come and you can go and see those films.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Denise, Shah and Chen, for joining us today and talking about, for me, which was for me one of the best events of last year, or the best conference / workshop of the year. For now, let's have a bit of music. This is Crack Cloud with Graph of Desire. When you cannot love without possessing,
friction stays the same, condition never takes.
Like a cold yellow fever in a hot air balloon,
deception on the rise as you shiver in disguise.
From the cradle you are nurtured, and in learning you are kept, and in labor you are kept, and in leisure you are kept, and in liberty you are swept. From the very foundation that I tell you to possess, 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 with the mad determination for papaya to success.
Yes, that was the amazing Crack Cloud with Graph of Desire. Now, since Studio Visit began in 2012, I've had the privilege of speaking to some of the most inspiring and innovative figures operating in the contemporary art world. And I want to take a moment to remember six people who have sadly passed away during the 8 years that this show has been on air. Their names are Alana Lockwood, Carolee Schneeman, Susan Hiller, Jean Fisher, Tim Rollins and Ben Cove. Each of these people have left an indelible mark on my own soul and, I believe, on the international artistic community. They've also left a legacy of ideas and creative work that will continue to be an inspiration to many. If you'd like to have a listen to their past interviews, each of them can be accessed at www.studiovisit.com. But I wanted to play a clip of the brilliant and beautiful Ben Cove here. For me, he's one of the best artists of my generation, and I think he was obviously snatched way too early. But this, for me, is one of the nicest sections of the interview that we did together a few years ago. And it's Ben talking about a video or film he did about Le Corbusier's building, the Unité d'Habitation.
So I was in southern France on holiday, and I booked for me and my ex to go and stay at the Unité d'Habitation because there's a hotel there. And so we kind of went there, and again, it's an amazing building. And the roof is the kind of the bit that makes it, really. And so I was on the roof, and I was sort of videoing stuff just for my own sort of pleasure. And so you're sort of surrounded on the roof by, there's mountains on one side, there's a sea, it was hot, and there's these sort of concrete structures on the roof of this building which are sculptural and otherworldly. And it's kind of, it's nuts. And as I was filming, there's a kindergarten in the building, because this building, you know, it contains like apartments, offices, shops, schools. It's a place you're not supposed to leave, basically. But during this time I was filming, these kids came out for their recess and started running around this outdoor pool that was on the roof. So I was sort of filming this, thinking, you know, this is like, utopia exists in the 21st century, and here it is where it's meant to be, on the roof of this building, with these kids running around screaming and having a great time in the sun. And I filmed this for like literally a minute, and then one of the teachers told one of the kids to come and talk to me. So after a minute of this, this girl runs up to the camera and says to me in French, "It's not permitted to film children." So I then turned the camera off in paranoia of like, oh God, you know.
Yeah, right.
So it was just like, this kind of summed up to me, you know, it's 21st century paranoia meets kind of 1950s utopia.
That was the late Ben Cove talking about his film of Le Corbusier's Unité d'Habitation. Now it's time to bring in Amanpreet and Jonathan to talk to us about their highlights of 2019. So, I mean, I can see you both stretching. but let me see who I'm going to talk to first. Let me go to you, Amin, actually. So you were saying that you've changed your mind about some of your highlights.
Yeah, because there's things that I like, and then I think there are things that are worth noting. So I was just thinking in terms of, like, curatorially, what I've really enjoyed is Louise Shelley, who's the Qubit curatorial fellow, who's coming to the end of her time at the moment at Qubit. And Louise is a really interesting curator because now for about approximately 4 years, they've really been interested in working with communities in a really embedded way. So in the showroom, which is based off the Edgware Road, Louise was working on something called communal knowledge. And that's before she got her fellowship. And a lot of that thinking around sort of how you build support structures, and to bring sort of voices that don't necessarily get heard in the art world, she's continued through her programme. And also I wanted to highlight it because it's quite different from previous fellowships. And, you know, I describe her programme as a bit of a quiet storm. But within that, there's been really nice solo presentations. And three to flag up is Lucy Clout's work, who's a filmmaker who's been working for a while, so who had a presentation at the start of a year, so it was a film installation. Ian Bailey, working with sound, again, someone who's been working for a long time, and that solo presentation was long overdue. And at the moment as well, you know, a younger artist, Deborah Finlader. So there's still time to go and see Louise's programme. So it's ending at the end of December. And also, it's just an indication of that fellowship still important. It's one of the only curatorial fellowships which, you know, needs to be addressed in itself. But it's a really important platform. And then I just wanted to switch up because I was thinking about...
Switch it up, go for it, don't worry.
I was thinking about what else did I like, which isn't necessarily kind of, you know, contemporary art related. And I have to say I really loved Dave the rapper, who won the Mercury Prize this year, and his performance with Alex on the Glastonbury stage. And I know that's a weird thing to highlight, but I think just in terms of what that sort of Glastonbury meant this year with Stormzy headlining, but also just where kind of grime has got to and the fact that it was platformed quite a bit.
We were all sort of, before you came, we were all like Denise and I, everybody were talking about sort of Stormzy's moment this year.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was saying he's looking good physically.
Yeah, definitely like, is.
I wanted his personal trainer's number, you know.
That, and then also just, I've been watching a lot of HBO old series, but documentaries, and two I just wanted to kind of flag up. One was a documentary, not on HBO, but by a young American director called Bing Liu, called Minding the Gap.
Great film.
Yeah, really, really good. And I just think, just in terms of a director and how he manages to show a really beautiful, intimate portrait of a group of his friends. So this whole documentary is based around skateboarding, his group of friends.
Oh, that was a brilliant documentary. Yeah. Tell me, go on.
So his group of friends really find solace in, you know, just being together and skating. But also this kind of friendship has, like, you know, a sort of a different aspect to it, because slowly throughout the documentary you find out there's sort of domestic violence that exists in sort of in different ways in each of their relationships. So it looks at friendship and masculinity and actually how through generations sort of domestic violence ends up kind of, I guess, like transmitting in the patterns that end up sort of subconsciously being kind of passed down.
Can we just say the name of the documentary?
Yeah, Minding the Gap.
Yeah. Oh, did you say it already? Yeah. This is a brilliant doc. Did you see that, Jonathan?
Yeah. It's you know, it's one of those films that no one else but, you know, someone who was part of that group could have made. Embedded, longitudinal study. I mean, he made it over many years because he picked up a camera, I think, when he was 14 first and finished it at 23 or something. So he was really young. But it was, you know, over the period of them coming of age, really, and over time. And it's a remarkable document and just really, you know, observed from the inside, from the ground level, organically.
And also, like coming of age seems like such a basic term to describe the film, doesn't it? Because it's not like this notion of coming of age, like you get to a certain age and then you're an adult and that's the end of the film. But it really showed how the development of self is just sort of ongoing and trying to work through trauma. But also that how parents were kind of complicit as well, you know? And
because there's that brilliant moment where he's interviewing his mum, and there's this kind of moment of recognition finally where, you know, there wasn't an honest conversation that had ever happened around his relationship with his stepfather. So really, you know, really promising director, really beautiful film.
Okay, so Jonathan, let me just bring you in now, because in terms of duration, let's talk about the longest. me and you spent 4 hours in the cinema together watching Anand Pathwardhan's brilliant film Vivek,
yes.
Or Reason. Tell us about it. For me, this was the film of the year.
Well, yeah, it's extraordinary because I had not really encountered his work previously. So his new film it screened at the London Indian Film Festival, which is where we saw it. 4 hour long study, again a longitudinal shot over many years, study of the rise of the Hindutva movement in India, and again it's embedded filmmaking. It's Anand Pathwardhan, you know, at the ground level, him and his camera, you know, alone most of the time. And he's not, you know, he's not looking to tell the story from the big players. He's looking at the foot soldiers and building the narrative from the ground up. And he's looking at the ordinary people on both sides, the people who are pushing this Hindutva movement, and the activists who are battling against it. And and after seeing that, I kind of went back and started looking at some of his earlier films.
Oh, they're brilliant, aren't they? He's like a master.
Yeah. I mean, he's been making films since the late 60s, I think, since he did his film studies in the US. And he's really sort of, you know, documented modern India in, you know, the way no one else has. And I really think his work should be better known. I mean, you know, certainly in the UK, but everywhere.
I have to say, like, as soon as we saw that film, I was like, I really want to interview Anand. And oh, actually, before that, I saw the trailer and I was like, I want to interview him. And this is how you can tell he's real, right? Like, anyone I want to get on the show who's big and is doing films, they're real if you can contact them. They've got a website with their email address on it. There's not an assistant. There's not a studio. I emailed him. He got back to me the next day. Like, that kind of blew my mind because he's in the middle of, like, festivals and it's a big film. It's like, you know, it's a sort of main attraction at a lot of film festivals. And he was totally open and up for doing this. And but what really spoke to me about his films was that they're both informative, but they don't surrender poeticism. They don't surrender poeticism in order to tell you a kind of journalistic truth.
Yeah, he is dididactic to a point.
But it has to be.
Yeah, obviously he has to be. But he's not surrendering. Music, for example, is a huge part of his films because the activists in the movement, they use music, you know, in the way that activists often do, and songs, and those are built into the narrative. So those elements of the poetic and people's personal, you know, stories and the personal alongside the political are always there. The two, you know, are always intertwined.
And there was one bit I don't know if you shed a tear in this moment, but there was one bit in the film where a young activist, basically part of the situation is there's a rise of, like, sort of Hindu nationalism, Modi as president's presidency, and also the RSS, and stretching all the way back to Gandhi, right? But there is also this sort of Dalit resistance, the resistance of untouchables, and the young man who's at university who just wants to be like an astrologer, and passes away and leaves this note, which was just one of the most heart-wrenching. Well,
he takes his own life.
I mean, I fully just cried in the cinema. But it's honestly, it's an amazing experience and warrants the 4-hour mark in the way that the risible Irishman from Martin Scorsese does not warrant 3.5 hours. It doesn't even warrant 10 minutes. But anyway, that's maybe a controversial position. Let's talk about some of your other selections, Jonathan. So you had Frank Bowling at Take Britain. Did you see that as well, Amon?
I did, and I loved it. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about
that. Yeah, yeah. I think maybe some of my, because I went for some of our choices that were maybe a little obvious, but they were just shows that were just really good shows, and that I was just very happy to see. I saw the Frank Bowling twice, and the Faith Ringgold at the Serpentine, both, you know, career retrospective shows that were just, you know, great shows by great artists and long overdue to kind of see, you know, those shows. I mean, emotionally, the Faith Ringgold bowled me over. I cried. I can't remember when last I cried in the gallery like that.
It wasn't out of frustration.
It wasn't out of frustration. It was out of pure, you know, just joy and love and sorrow all mixed up together.
I thought the Frank Bowling show was really well curated, and in a way that Tate exhibitions generally aren't. Sometimes they feel as if there's like almost like an IKEA instruction manual that the curators have to follow, but part of it doesn't stop them from like shoving too much work. Mm. You know, like the Nam June Paik show, for example, is another thing where there's just so much work in the exhibition. But the Frank Bowling one, the pieces seem to have room to breathe, which is exactly what they needed. Did you feel that as well?
Yeah, I did. As you say, it was, well, I mean, it was chronological, which can have its pitfalls. But it, I mean, it was the works that were chosen were well chosen to represent the periods that they represented. And it was curated in a way that made you realize just how vital he's kind of always been. The work has always been changing, and he's always been thinking, and, you know, just kind of always just pushing his practice forward, you know, wherever he's been and whatever he's been doing.
And I mean, were there other exhibitions that caught your eye? Because I remember you mentioning something about public programs. Was that what changed your mind about?
Yeah, no. So this is I need to kind of think about that a bit more, because I've just been too close to it, because I've been working on it. On a lot of public programming. But I think it's an interesting moment for public programming, just because there's been, you know, over the last 5 years, exhibitions has have functioned in more of a public programming way, and public programming has expanded from just like straightforward talks and study days. But I don't think I do want to maybe kind of mention that. But connected to sort of what Jonathan's been speaking about, I think Denzel Forrester's also someone worth bringing up. I didn't actually see his show because he did have a show at Stephen Friedman Gallery, I think, earlier this year. But I did see his piece at Brixton Station, which is part of Art on the Underground.
I saw that as well, yeah.
Mural project. And it's a reinterpretation or a reimagining of his seminal work, Three Wicked Men, and it's called Brixton Blue, this new piece. But just in terms of like a painter that, you know, hasn't sort of got his dues, in terms of sort of painterly composition, you know, thinking about sort of rhythm, and just, it's just a really good painter. So I'm really looking forward to it. There's a show coming up next year, a solo presentation. So I'm really excited. To see sort of what's going to, yeah, what they're going to present, but also just a shout out for that particular programme, because it's all kind of riffing off Brixton murals, which were kind of quite political murals from the 1980s.
Yeah, there was a lot of like CND stuff that would appear. You know, can I just ask, is this the first time that Art on the Underground have commissioned a mural?
I think it is in its kind of current form, and it's a mural that's
within a station.
But if
anyone's listening from Art on the Underground, it's a no-brainer. You should do more of them. More of them and less of the weird cryptic things that are just on a poster when you come out of the ticket machines. Like, nobody understands those projects, guys. Like, we understand paintings on a wall, or maybe we understand interventions that are doing something with advertising, but all this subtle stuff, like changing a travel card and that, no one's interested in. Just to let you guys know. And maybe you can... Anyway, I'll leave
controversial,
that
Morgan. Controversial.
It's not controversial. I'm just a citizen who's just
Yeah, but I think this is why the Brixton commissions are working so well, you know, and bringing really good artists. But, yeah, and... Yeah, nothing more to say there.
All right, so Jonathan, what I want to do now is there was a moment, I want to bring Denise, Shah and Jen back in, because there was a moment in the workshop where someone in the audience said, you were discussing the topic of isolation in relation to British Chinese women. And someone in the audience said, look at the Caribbean community in the UK. It's so unified. That they're always working. Well, it just seemed there's no sense of isolation. They have everything together. And I thought that's interesting, because if you probably went to a similar event, there might be someone there who'd say the same thing about the Chinese community in England. And there's other similarities, like we could talk about Saturday schooling and the supplementary schools movement, blah, 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 blah. But I then was thinking about that in relation to the exhibition that you mentioned, Jonathan, which was...
Stand Up.
It was Get Up, Stand Up at Somerset House. So what the idea was saying, if there's an impression that there is this sort of unified Caribbean community speaking with a single voice, I think that exhibition exposed the lie, really, because what you have are different people vying for the right to offer that like community identity. And I think for me, this was a moment where my conception of British Caribbean identity came up against the fiction. And I don't know if that's how you felt, Jonathan. Let me hear it.
Well, you know, if someone's approached and told, you know, we're giving you an opportunity, you know, if a major established, you know, exhibition space comes to you and says, we're giving you this opportunity to create this show that tells a narrative, and you know, I don't know, and I can't assume that a particular person, you know, or there was a particular side that kind of pushed how the narrative should be. But, you know, if it ends up being sort of like, this is the story, right? Then, you know, then it's kind of like, so there's only one, and only one show can tell, you know, one story, and it all has to be in this one show and nothing else. I mean, you know, it's problematic going in. So
I think that the Caribbean is a really interesting place because it's so multicultural. There's a South Asian, South and East Asian communities, African communities. There's so many people there.
And I mean, it's, of course, divided too linguistically. You know, there's the English-speaking Caribbean, which in the UK, most people assume, well, that's what you're talking about when you say the Caribbean. But, of course, there's Haiti, there's Cuba and the Spanish-speaking countries. There's the Dutch Caribbean. You know, so it's much more mixed than is often reflected.
Denise, can I ask you now, thinking about the future, like, in a way, on the horizon, can you see this idea of people trying to offer, you know, the authoritative take on what is British Chinese or British British-born Chinese identity? Can you see that hazard on the horizon?
I mean,
possibly.
Yeah, I mean, there was a question that was asked from the audience, and, you know, it was quite quite a heated question, shall I say, you know, and it was really wanting to drill down the definition of a British Chinese identity, you know, and this, you know, very kind of frustrated sort of question that was like, I don't know why we're sitting here in this room, you know, I want you to tell me what a British Chinese identity is, and you, if you can't give me a definition, then I'm leaving.
I remember that moment.
Long story short, you know, and, you know, I do think that sense of frustration is also in relationship to this kind of, I don't know, dominant British white culture, you know, this desire to have this sense of certainty, you know, that unity, right? That, that you know, it has to be one thing or like a thing rather than this multiplicity, which is like way more complex and way more interesting for anyone to kind of get their heads around, right? You know, and wanting, you know, and then being in a marginalized position and feeling like I want to have something that I know that I can say, but then equally that in itself being an impossible fiction, right? Being an impossible fiction. So I do think, you know, in terms of, I think it is really dangerous to kind of, you know, to kind of lay out, you know, what a British Chinese identity is. And I think, you know, something that came out of all the presentations, you know, was that there are multiple lines, multiple views, and that is part of the dialogue. This is part of the discourse. And recognizing this difference and appreciating that for what it is, you know.
Yeah, I think you're like, maybe that is part of it somehow, because I've been reading a bit of post-colonial theory lately, and sometimes it does, it feels like, you know, some of the leftovers, the diluted readings of post-colonial theory really simplify it. And there have been people really like fighting their way through some of these problems, but all we get are the dichotomies now. We get local, global, West versus the third world or the margin in the center. Yeah. We don't get any of the other stuff that people have really talked about. And this is one of them, that this will to forge a singular and consistent identity maybe is itself rooted in the kind of conception of the West. Like nationalism, where does that even come from? And maybe difference is the thing that we need to hold on to, but maybe it's hard. What do you think, Amon?
Oh, I don't know where to start, but with that. But I think it serves people, right, to have those viewpoints, and especially when I'm thinking about those kind of discourses that are taking place in the art world and how certain people are getting behind, may it be kind of diversity strategies or sort of accessibility, and I don't know. I just think it's a lot more complicated, and I think sometimes just the structures of the art world in part are an issue as well, because I don't think that that kind of difference or that complexity is kind of held very well in the structures that we have. And when I'm talking about the structures, I'm talking organisationally, I'm talking about how these conversations are funded, and yeah, so it's, I'm like really interested in that, but we need more kind of thinkers that are foregrounding and researching that. I guess like all of you are really, because it's the same voices that you hear as well. And that's what's made that kind of post-colonial discourse go in a particular way or be foregrounded in the way that it has.
Yeah, and people still discussing diaspora, and it's like, okay, that's an interesting point, but what is next? And that's why I thought your conference was, I keep calling it a conference workshop, seminar. That's why I thought it was so brilliant, really, because it showed, like I say, it was foundational, but then it also showed a future as well. You know, it wasn't just going over old territory, which I think is possibly what that person in the audience was trying to do. Mm-hmm. It was almost saying, who are you to push it somewhere else?
I think you know, I think this notion of a future is something that is really, it's like a really pertinent question. You know, I think something that we're kind of asking ourselves as well, you know, and I think this notion of a future is you know, I think something that I've really learned through the research and also through the event is that this notion of a future is really, you know, it has to be held within a collective space, right? I think first and foremost, it needs to be brought together in dialogue in order to even know who is in the room. You know, I think, you know, something that was kind of really coming up in my research, and I think kind of, you know, in other people's research as well in different ways, was just, I don't know anybody else, you know, who is like me. Mm. Right. So I do think this question of a future isn't, you know, in a way doesn't even belong to us, really. Right. Mm. You know, it's just about creating a space in which that conversation can happen. You know, and I think also, you know, everything that is going on with the UK, with China, with Hong Kong, with, you know, wider Southeast Asia, you know, all that, you know, that is, that in itself has a strong hand to play in terms of, you know, British Chineseness, Southeast Asianness, you know, that all that dialogue is kind of still in like so much formation right now.
And then I feel the moment when everybody starts to have these cross-cultural discussions about things is really when the lid is going to be blown off. I feel that's what might be happening in 2020. Like, suddenly everybody will start to get together a bit more and realise that the conversations that we're having in Britain, about Britain, are useful up to a certain point, but the world is huge. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and has lots to offer. You know, and we have lots to offer it, possibly. Controversial?
I don't think so.
No.
Let's do it.
Wholeheartedly.
Let's do it. Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this evening, I'm afraid, and for this year, and for this decade. But I just want to say thanks to my guests, Jonathan Ali, Amanpreet Sandhu, Denise Kwan, Sha Zhou, and Chunyang, and I've been Morgan Quaintance. I've been Morgan Quaintance for 8 years. And I promise I'm going to be back in 2020 and still going strong and bringing you some of the best in contemporary art, theory, writing, contemporary dance, just about any artistic expression that you can put under the umbrella of contemporary art. First of all, is going to be one of the most incredible contemporary poets working today, and that is the masterful Lee Young Lee. So that my interview with him will be with you on the first Wednesday of February, because Resonance isn't on air the first week of January. And you know what? I hope you all have an amazing Christmas. And also, I hope that when we get back after Christmas, the right government is in power. I'm forbidden from saying who I want, but you all know who I want in power. And but I can't say it because Ofcom will crack down on me like, I don't know, a schoolmaster with a cane to a naughty boy. But thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in next year.